Welcome to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society, a 501c3 nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. I'm Jeannie Horeska, and this is part one of our two-part series on the Electoral Count Act. If the ECA sounds familiar, it is because it played a prominent role in the legal fictions clung to by those who orchestrated the January 6th insurrection. With another presidential election now just months away, we thought it worth asking, what's changed about the ECA, and are we confident in its durability heading into what could be the most consequential election cycle for our democracy? The final few weeks of 2023 were also particularly busy when it comes to the U.S. Supreme Court, and we will review a few big-ticket items on that front. To help me sort through all of this, I am joined by ACS Senior Director for Policy and Program, Lindsay Langholz. Listeners of Broken Law know Lindsay well as a frequent host of the show. Lindsay, welcome back to Broken Law.
Thank you so much. It's so nice to be on this side of the microphone, if you will.
It's a fun way to start the new year.
Yeah.
So this is going to be a mammoth year.
Yeah.
But we're going to start with a very quick review of how 2023 ended. There were a few big developments when it comes to the Supreme Court, kind of over the holiday. So if folks missed it, we wanted to do a quick recap. What's happening? What did happen that folks should be aware of as we prepare for all things 2024?
There's a couple of big cases that the court granted cert for or took up at the end of the year, and a couple that we've been tracking on this podcast, so good to kind of catch up on those. The first is the court has taken up the mifepristone case. This is the medication abortion case that we've talked about quite a bit in previous episodes. The court decided to go ahead and take up an appeal there.
Which was long expected.
Yes, absolutely. And listen, I am not one to be hopeful about this court and their positions on abortion, but I should note that they took up two of the cases that deal with this issue, but not a third. So basically, for those who either haven't listened to previous episodes or maybe have forgotten, the Fifth Circuit issued a decision in this case or set of cases that basically took a position that wasn't as extreme as the district court case, which is not hard to do.
Yeah, this came out of Judge Kaczmarek's court, and
right.
if there's a district court judge that is infamously known by name, it's Kaczmarek.
Absolutely, and they seek him out, right? So
yeah.
The Fifth Circuit is not a paragon of moderation, but they did pull back where he went. So he basically said, the entire project of mifepristone should be rolled back. I'm going to attack the original authorization, which is what the folks who sought him out asked for. The Fifth Circuit said, we're not going to go that far. What we are going to do is roll back some advancements that the FDA approved. And so it kind of took us back to this middle place where mifepristone would still be available, but would have all these conditions that were rolled back by the FDA as the drug was on the market for a longer time. I should note that as SCOTUS takes this up, the stay that was in place remains in place. Mifepristone is still available. It is still available under the conditions that people have come to enjoy and expect. And that will be true until SCOTUS does whatever it's going to do with this case. So the short version of what's happening right now is access remains as it has been. But now they've taken up the Fifth Circuit part. They did deny the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine's petition to look back and try to go back to that withdrawing the drug entirely. Having said that, SCOTUS can still do what it's going to do. It's not like they're not ones to keep themselves to precedent on this issue. So we'll see how it develops. But that is the kind of way that they sorted through the questions that were asked of them.
In terms of timing, you'd expect oral argument to happen sometime this spring and a decision to come down in June as part of the court's regular decision period?
That's exactly right. They have scheduled themselves through mid-January so far for oral argument, at least as of this recording. And so it's certainly not going to happen this month. It's likely to be later in the term just because there's a lot of cases for them to take up. And the lower court decision right now is on hold. And so the urgency is one that they can mitigate by just keeping that stay in place. So likely the spring, summer decision.
All right. So that's a big case. And again, we will also be updating listeners on this come oral argument, come final decision. So stay tuned. That wasn't the only big development that the end of 2023 brought. There was also a big case out of Colorado.
Yes. So those who've been listening to the podcast recently will know that we talked to our friends at CREW about their case out of Colorado to use the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to disqualify Trump from the primary ballot in Colorado. Those who've listened will remember that the lower court in Colorado said, yes, he participated in insurrection. Yes, all of these different questions, except that he's not covered by Section 3 of the 14th Amendment because the president is unique. Office doesn't mean office. It's a little bit of a confusing decision there. So the state Supreme Court heard appeals from both sides, took up all the different questions, and said, we believe that the lower court was right, except for this question about whether or not Trump was covered by the 14.3 provisions. We do believe that the presidency is covered in terms of the oath of office that's taken, and so he has been disqualified from the ballot. Now, they did say that their decision is stayed until the Supreme Court can deal with it, because this is obviously a very new, novel, whatever adjective you want to put, it is unprecedented. It is an untested theory for this century.
And Section 3 of the 14th is being litigated in other states.
Yes, it's being litigated in a couple of different places, but this is the first case to make it.
There's reason for the Supreme Court to say, okay, there is a need for a final answer.
Absolutely.
On whether this applies, how it applies.
Yep.
So it sounds like the Colorado Supreme Court knew its decision was going to get appealed.
Yep. I mean, they issued like a over 200 page opinion in a very short amount of time. So it's clear that they were laying out how they see it, but creating a record for the court to look at as they sort through an appeal. There's timing issues here. So
yeah,
it's the beginning of a new year for everybody at home. The calendar is about to get really complicated to follow. So here's what we do know. The primary in Colorado is March 5th. It is part of Super Tuesday. But as everybody who listens to the podcast knows, election administration takes time. So even though March 5th is when
ballots have to be printed.
Ballots have to be printed 45 days before to allow for military, overseas voters, and early voters to be able to cast a ballot. Colorado does all mail ballots. And so everything has to be done certified by the Secretary of State in Colorado by January 5th. So a few days after this episode releases, it's a very short turnaround for the court. It is possible that the court tries to deal with this before we get to that place. It's also very possible that they just kind of put everything on hold and say, the primary can go forward. We'll deal with this at the pace that we feel comfortable. It's really unknown, at least as of recording. But for those keeping track of their calendars at home, around March is when we were also expecting the DC trial to take place for Trump's participation in the January 6th events. There's appeals going on there too at SCOTUS. So there's just a lot of legal activity going on, a lot of stuff that's going to happen in this first part of the year, because courts are trying to sort through these issues before we get to November, because if you kick the can down the road, it only creates...
Well, isn't there a Supreme Court precedent that says you don't change major electoral issues right before an election? And what the time frame is for right before an election is up to interpretation.
There is. It's called the Purcell Principle. The court in recent years has used it when they wanted to.
I was going to say, it's there when they need it and to be ignored when they don't.
Yeah. And I think what's particularly complicated about this set of issues is there's multiple points where that could be true, where it's a little too close or too late. But as you mentioned, there's other cases that are working their way through the courts right now where the courts have said it's too early. And so it's a really complicated question of when is the right timing to deal with this? And courts have not landed in the same place. And so definitely something that we are keeping an eye on as we go into this new year is how does this all get sorted out and when? when so that voters have the information that they need, get to actually weigh in, or the courts could come out and say, actually, this is a question for Congress and we're not dealing with it at all. So a year from now, we would get that question answered. It's unusual because it's so unprecedented, the facts and the situation that we're dealing with. But it's worth sorting out because, you know, these are big questions that we're supposed to be able to tackle.
Yeah. And as you know, there's just going to be so much happening in early 2024. So between ACS emails, our podcasts, our publications, we are going to try and keep everybody up to date. But it is quite possible that we'll record an episode on a Wednesday or Thursday and something will happen before the following Tuesday. So
stay tuned.
We will do our best.
Yes.
Is there anything else on the Supreme Court front that's worth highlighting before we jump into the ECA?
Yeah, there's one more case that I figure would be worth kind of, it was granted cert the same day as the Mifepristone case. And that is this question that is related to that January 6th trial at the DC case against Trump, but it also implicates a lot of these other January 6th prosecutions. And that is a question of whether a statute that's been used in these cases, there's a question about whether or not the corruptly obstructing congressional session is valid, is constitutional. It is a key piece of the legal tools that prosecutors have been using in pursuing these January 6th cases. And saying that they have been illegally obstructing this congressional act, this congressional session, something that we'll talk about as we talk about the ECA for sure.
Yeah.
But it is a question that the court is going to have to weigh in on before the rest of this Trump litigation can proceed. And so it has been appealed up to SCOTUS. The court did take it up at the end of 2023. They have not set timing on it yet. But we expect, again, some of this is reading tea leaves, but we expect that they will hear it pretty quickly just because in order for this litigation to all kind of work and the complicated calendaring, they need to have an answer sooner rather than later. And Jack Smith asked them to do this in a pretty expedited manner so that we can get resolution.
The court has really set itself up to be working quite a few days this spring.
It certainly will be. And some of this is not bad that the court is taking it up. I mean,
some would be sooner rather than later would be ideal.
Exactly. I think the common thread of many of these updates is clarity, and clarity sooner rather than later is a good thing. And so it's hard with this court. It's not like, oh, yay, SCOTUS is just weighing in here, there, and everywhere. But there's a reason that, for example, Jack Smith asked them to weigh in early. Like, they're going to have to answer these questions. And so in many cases, sooner than rather than later, given the calendar and the way that the election is unfolding, is going to end up being helpful.
Yeah, it sounds like it's almost inevitable that we're going to get decisions in the midst of the primary calendar.
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean,
yeah, it's just going to be. Yeah.
We've got Iowa very soon after.
Yeah.
This,
oh my goodness.
So like, we're here. We're now in the process, and as everything gets sorted through, it's time now. 2024 is going to have a lot of questions answered, and
for good, bad, or otherwise, we're at least going to know.
They're going to get answered.
Yeah.
We don't know what those answers are, if they're good, bad, or ugly.
You're listening to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society. If you're enjoying Broken Law, consider becoming a member of ACS today. You do not need to be a lawyer to be a member. As we discuss so often on this podcast, our laws and legal systems impact all of us. By supporting ACS, you support Broken Law, our work to diversify the federal bench, and our advocacy for Supreme Court reform. You also become a member of our nationwide network. Learn more about ACS by visiting our website at acslaw.org. And now, back to the conversation. We're also just a few days out from January 6th, 2024. So we're going to do a quick review of the Electoral Count Act. I think there is a lot of fear, consternation, downright terror about 2024. And so our hope is to at least potentially alleviate some concern when it comes to this issue. So as to start us off, can you just remind us how the Electoral Count Act played into the January 6th insurrection?
Absolutely. So on January 6th, 2021, Congress was meeting to go through the electoral votes of every state and certify president-elect. The way that that works is, everybody listening, I'm sure, knows, the Electoral College meets, submits a slate of electors, and then those electors are for one candidate or another, and Congress sorts through those electoral votes before going through the process of formalizing a president being elected. That process of counting the ballots and going through is something that has not gone without incident many times in the past. It is a system that has at numerous points in our history been fraught, but went without any real ramifications because of a series of kind of norms created and some papering over of holes in the law that governed this process. But as early as when George Washington decided not to run for a third term, and there was the first actual competitive presidential election, there were already problems, right? There were things that the framers did not foresee. And so for the first couple, the Congress at the time was like, we need to resolve this. And so they passed the 12th Amendment. They passed and then was certified by the states, the 12th Amendment, to deal with some of the issues that came up early. So things like, what happens if there's a tie? What happens if there's, you know, small things that happened early? But even then, if you look back at the history, there were issues with the slates submitted by states that kind of just got dealt with unofficially. And early on, the vice president of the time was Thomas Jefferson when he was running to be president, and he got a slate from Georgia that was funky. All we know from the reporting and the news at the time was like, there were problems. He just kind of quietly mentioned them, and then they got resolved pretty quickly, and like, it was just handled. And you fast forward even to, you know, when Richard Nixon was the vice president and going through the process of overseeing the same process, there were problems that came out of Hawaii and their electoral slate. And he was like, well, to not set a precedent, I think we should just accept this slate and like move on. And so there were many times in our history where there were issues, but there were issues that the system dealt with in a way that didn't require huge legal questions to be answered. Everybody wanted there to be a peaceful transition of power. Everybody put this emphasis on, you know, country over electoral outcome, and we moved on.
Until 2021.
Until 2020, where all of these flaws that were exposed in previous years were all shown, and we barely survived. And so what was disrupted on January 6th, the reason that January 6th was chosen as this day that they were going to go and have this rally that turned violent, that turned into an insurrection, was to disrupt this count. And the theory was, we're going to buy more time for these legal suits that we have floating out there, the Kraken, for those who want a little PTSD of being thrown back into the news.
Yeah.
But all these legal challenges that they were pursuing, they wanted to buy more time. And so there were a couple different ways that they tried to pursue that. Ted Cruz threw out a commission to like to deal with these issues. But then finally, all that was left was to object, to try and force objections, to lengthen that time. And then finally, the insurrection.
To just physically disrupt it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was all an effort to just slow it down and then finally to this.
But all, it seemed also all meant to take advantage of these little holes in the ECA that left enough ambiguity, enough questions that folks willing to push felt like they might have success.
Absolutely. And we've seen even from just, you know, the January 6th committee and other places, other reporting, that this was a legal theory that was bought into by Jenny Thomas and some of Justice Thomas's former clerks, members of Congress. Like, it was definitely a fringe legal theory, but not one without a number of people in power pursuing. They had reason to believe that we'll try it and see if we can't make it happen.
And I remember after January 6th, kind of after the dust had settled, the election had been certified, there was bipartisan recognition. We need to fix the ECA.
Absolutely. And I think there's been recognition for a while that there are problems with this law, right? So the ECA was enacted in 1887 at a time where they were literally having to factor in how long was reasonable for a buggy to make it to the Capitol with these like slates, right? Like, literally,
we have problems today, but figuring that out is not one of them.
Exactly. And so it was a structure that was built to address the issue at the time. It looked backwards and addressed issues that had popped up in the recent past, but it was not a law that was passed with an idea of, okay, we can foresee issues coming forward. And so you fast forward and you have a good period of time where there aren't really any issues, but you hit the 1960s and all of a sudden there start to be new flaws in this patchwork of laws and norms that are exposed that really ramp up. And you start to see that after the 2000 election. So Bush v. Gore really brings to the forefront problems with the ECA. And ever since then, there's been a real understanding, bipartisan, that there are problems with this law that could create issues in the future. And it took the events of January 6, 2021 to really actually create some momentum for there to be reform.
It just reminds me so much what you said of the ECA was originally drafted with a rear view mirror.
Yeah.
And we always have that problem is we fail to imagine what could happen. And so we're always reacting. So the ECA was remedied with a rear view mirror, again, looking back at the January 6th insurrection and trying to fix the gaps that it so clearly revealed or highlighted. So talk to me about the changes that were made post January 6th, 2021.
So in the aftermath, a bipartisan group got together. At first, it was part of a larger democracy reform issue or package of laws. And it kind of got whittled down. I don't know if folks remember, it's been a long 2 years or 3 years, but it got whittled down to just this and then some succession, small tinkering, but these two kind of pieces of a larger problem. And the House had a version that was suggestive as part of the January 6th committee's final recommendations was you need to pass at the time it was a bill in the House. And then the Senate kind of came forward with their own version. The Senate version is the one that won out. But even then it took the bill being passed as part of an omnibus bill. It did not pass by itself. It was kind of one of these giant...
There was that brief period right after the insurrection when there was massive bipartisan political will to do this. And then you could just see it dissipate almost by the day.
And so they made it through. They squeaked it in as part of this omnibus bill that was the last passed when Democrats controlled each part of the process of both chambers and the presidency. And so it's hard. It was still with bipartisan support. It's hard to know how many exactly just because it passed as part of this process. And that is the Electoral Count Reform Act. And as you said, it again looks backwards. So it addresses some of these flaws that were exposed and really taken advantage of after the 2020 election. But that's about it. It doesn't do a ton of forward looking, trying to get ahead of new issues. But it's important, nonetheless. It's an important law that really helped clear up some vague language in the 1887 Act that folks took advantage of on January 6th, 2021, and tries to do some of this codification of norms that had gotten us through until then.
I remember one of the things it explicitly did was clarify the role of the vice president.
Yes.
And if, again, nobody likes to think back to this, but if we recall January 6th, one of the big issues was Trump pressuring Vice President Pence not to certify.
Yes.
That issue has been dealt with.
That issue has been dealt with. And it came out of, in theory, I don't want to give it too much credit, but in theory, some vagueness in the law from 1887 that dealt with the vice president's role, but also with some constitutional
Every person that Pence consulted, and he's talked about this, told him, you don't have this option.
Right.
So it wasn't like there was a gap in the law. It was, you know, a small, tiny, tiny shade of gray.
Exactly.
That has been 100% clarified. And so it now is very crystal clear that the vice president's role is ceremonial and ceremonial only.
He presides over the session, and so he has ability. Or she, absolutely. Sorry, of course. I was thinking of Pence, but yes. I'm glad to be thinking of a better world where we have had vice presidents who have now been women.
But they go in, they ceremonially oversee it.
And so they'll do things like they will recognize someone to speak, or they have certain defined
parliamentary procedure powers.
But they are not in a position to make decisions on their own or rule on certain issues. It is crystal clear in the law now that the vice president has very defined ceremonial roles.
So that was a big one.
Yes.
Now that there is no chance for a president to pressure a VP into doing anything. The other big change was about the threshold for objections in Congress, which again was something that we saw attempted in 2021.
Yes.
So what was the issue and how is it now addressed?
So before, the rule was that if you had at least one member of each chamber who had signed on to an objection, then each chamber would deal with the objection and vote within their own body.
That is a very low threshold.
It's a very low threshold. It was still hard to achieve often until 2021. We saw this after the 2000 election. There were members of the Congressional Black Caucus who objected based on claims of voter suppression in Florida. They did not have a member from the Senate to join, and so those were gaveled down. We saw it again in 2004, or the aftermath of the 2004 election. Barbara Boxer did join as the lone senator to hear the objection there. So the process went forward. They heard it in both chambers, and those objections were eventually overruled, essentially, and they went forward with counting the votes. That was Ohio in 2005 that they were dealing with. And 2016, they couldn't find a senator to join. So it was a situation where it was...
I feel like in today's political environment, which started, during the Trump administration, it would not be a high threshold.
The party structure is really solidified and become one of those things where it's like, there's going to be a block of folks. And so when you got to the situation on January 6, 2021, there was a question of how many people you needed. It was just one on each side, and they met that threshold. There were senators who joined House members. That threshold has now been raised to 1/5 or 20% of each chamber. It's a line drawing issue. Some people were like, it's too low still, like it needs to be even higher. 20% is definitely better than...
I was going to say, it's something.
It is something. And there's a reality here that there may be instances where there doesn't need to be a process.
You don't want to eliminate the opportunity for objection.
And so it is a much higher bar. It is a bar that would have been met in the House in 2021. So it's not going to solve all the issues by raising this threshold. But it is good to make it higher so that it's a kind of a reasonable standard, right? Like, can you get 1/5 of your chamber to agree to at least hear the objection?
It's 20 senators. Like that's a much higher threshold than one.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And it keeps kind of fringe groups from within caucuses, as we've seen in the House recently. Like sometimes it only takes 8 to really to be able to
keep the House without a speaker for a shocking duration of time
and really derail the whole process. And so you want that number to require more than just a small fringe group.
The last issue that And again, this is like thinking through all the things that somehow became common knowledge and part of our common vernacular, which was the false slate of electors.
Yeah.
A term that like none of us had thought that much of until now, where it is permanently cemented into our brain. States are still dealing with their false slate of electors. Nevada most recently became the latest state to announce charges against its false electors. Does the revision to the ECA address this concept, this possibility?
It does. It kind of clarifies a process that was already kind of there, but it really lays out the very specific. So it clarifies who in the state can certify a slate of electors, which before was a little unclear and created situations.
So kind of like the VP role where like most people got it, but there was just enough uncertainty to open the door.
Yeah. And to give an example from a previous election, in 1961, Hawaii had their first opportunity to participate in presidential elections as they'd just become a state. They had a recount that was ordered by a federal judge after what's called the Safe Harbor Law, and I'll explain that in a second, but after the deadline. So what ended up happening was the attorney general certified one slate, the governor certified a different slate, then there was a third slate. It became...
There was just utter confusion.
Yes. And so when we fast forward to 2021... That Hawaiian example was one that Trump supporters in Congress were particularly pointing to.
That multiple slates could be
and
certified.
Because of different recounts and legal issues that hadn't been resolved. And so what this does is say there's not going to be different state authorities appointing different groups. We're going to have a very defined system for who can certify an electoral slate and kind of give a process by which federal judges can hear challenges to a slate before we get to January 6th and kind of lays out that process too and defines who can bring those challenges and who hears them. And so it really just kind of creates a structure.
So as we noted earlier, these corrections were very much looking in the rear view. They were very specific to what happened in 2020 and 2021 and trying to prevent those problems from repeating.
Yeah.
It was not let's make the ECA fail safe across the board. So everybody I talk to already has a certain level of panic when it comes to 2024. And I am loath to add to that, but I do feel like we have to ask, were there any changes that were scrapped that didn't achieve bipartisan support? Are there any holes left in the ECA that should be noted? Doesn't mean they're immediately going to be seized upon after this next election, but do you have heartburn over anything specific?
The biggest one for me is, and I alluded to it before and I'll define it now, the safe harbor date. So in the ECA, the 1887 Act, there is a date by which if a state has certified their electors, then that's it. There's no litigating it. There's no any question, like that slate of electors is accepted. And the idea is to try and incentivize states to like get it all resolved,
wrap it up,
so that Congress isn't wading into these kinds of questions. The thing is the 1887 Act, again, was picking dates that were based on like how long it took the Western Union man to like get it to DC. And we've advanced technologically since then. And so there were folks who proposed either pushing that window to be much closer to when the electors actually meet in their respective states or scrapping it entirely, but it was left untouched. And so the reason that it gives me some heartburn is we are in a time when vote by mail and other advancements have been made to expand access to the ballot box. For some places, it takes time to process ballots to get them to a place where they're counted accurately. And so, all right, you've got that window. And then if you're going to have any kind of a time to deal with a recount, then that's additional time. And so you're getting very tight when it comes to what needs to happen. And so it puts pressure on election administrators to get things done by that safe harbor date. As we saw in 2020 into 2021, people understood that, like, if they could disrupt the count at the county level, then that would kind of push them past the safe harbor date and allow for more challenges and more uncertainty. And so election administrators are all under enormous pressure to get everything done. To leave the safe harbor date where it is creates a lot of tension.
What is the safe harbor date?
It's early December.
So roughly a month after Election Day. And which, like we saw with the 2020 presidential election, it wasn't called on Election Day. There are so many things that now happen after, you know, midnight on Election Day. So is the concern that even if the fixes to the ECA really ward off a January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol focused on that piece of the electoral process, the concern now is you see state-level insurrections, and so the focus is on disrupting the state process as opposed to the certification process?
Yes, and even beyond like violent insurrection or disruption.
Just causing delays and processes and just causing confusion. Yeah. It doesn't have to be a violent insurrection. It just has to be chaos and uncertainty.
Yes. So December 10th is the safe harbor date. The electors don't meet until the 16th. So there's 6 days where it's just like, we have this gap for real no reason. And this isn't a hypothetical problem. So this is why in the aftermath of the 2000 election, we saw the ECA come to the forefront.
Right.
Is because what happened there was SCOTUS stopped a recount and then said, oh, well, Florida wants to avail itself of the safe harbor protection. So no, like we're just not allowing this to go forward. Just done. And there were 6 other days or 7. I forget what the exact window
because
was.
Because it took so long for horses to travel. That's essentially the reason.
And so, like, I understand that there's processing time. You want to make sure you give yourself a little bit of wiggle room, but it is a weakness that, you know, we're going to have Election Day. Then you get a month to not only count everything, but to resolve everything, to get everything resolved. And there's real incentives for folks who want to push past the safe harbor day to create either litigation that's unnecessary or to create controversy to keep it from being resolved. But also it creates real pressure for folks who are trying to resolve legitimate controversies, right? You know, we've seen in Florida, for example, in the aftermath of the 2000 election, like there were real controversies about ballot design and about voter suppression tactics and all sorts of things that they were attempting to deal with that just got shut down. And so that's a biggie. That's a biggie that was left unresolved in ACRA that I think is going to, if not now, hopefully not now, but at some point become an issue. And it's one that we're going to have to just deal with when it comes up now.
You are hosting part two of this series. Can you give us a little preview of what will be discussed in the second part?
Yeah. So what we're looking at in the second part is, why are we dealing with all of this? Like, should we have an electoral college? That is
you mean why doesn't the popular vote just decide it and end it on Election Day? Because golly gee, that'd be nice.
Yes. And I, you know, we're going to be looking at how we got here and why we're contorting ourselves to deal with all of these issues. If there is a better way, what some reform options might look like. But really just kind of pull back and say, okay, it's nice that we kind of did some patchwork here and there. How democratic is all of this? And how should we move forward?
If you want to truly reckon with our electoral system, you do have to reckon with the Electoral College.
Yep.
Like at some point, that bill is going to come due.
Yeah.
Well, we are looking forward to that. So as our call to action at the end of this episode, I'll say just stay tuned and make sure to catch part two of this series. And again, this is going to be a very busy year. There's not going to be a lack of topics to discuss. So we're so glad that you are tuning in. Thank you to Lindsay for joining us for this episode. And you can help us bring the show to more listeners by recommending it to a friend or giving us a 5-star review. We would love that. Together, we'll speak truth to power about the law, whose interests it really serves, and whose it does not.